Hello, everybody, and welcome to 3 Point Perspective, the podcast about illustration, how to do it, how to make a living at it, and how to make an impact in the world with your art. I'm Jake Parker.
I'm Lee White.
And I'm Will Terry, and all three of us are professional illustrators, and we've all illustrated children's books for just about every major publisher. We've worked with just about every major author. No, that's not part of it. We haven't worked with all the major authors. We've taught illustration at all the major, no, not at all the major universities. We've taught illustration at universities. And there's something else in there that I forgot. So
that is correct. Each week we're going to come at you guys with a different topic in illustration. Sometimes we're going to agree, sometimes we're going to argue, but each time you are going to learn something brand spanking new.
So yesterday I went on Amazon and I typed in your names to see what books you guys have done, because I really wanted to like add up how many books and see what's legit. So on Amazon, I take it not every book you guys have done is on Amazon, because
some
you did a lot of books that are out of print. You did self-published books. But on Amazon, there's over 50 books between the three of us.
So should we go with that?
What I have on Amazon. No, because I've done 27 just by myself, and a bunch of those are not listed anymore. They're out of, like Jake said, print or whatever. But yeah. I still did them.
Yeah. It's interesting. Okay, before we get into the questions today, Lee and I were talking yesterday. We got a review on the iTunes, and it said, I was about to give you guys 1 star because it took forever for the episode to download. But I realized that wasn't your fault, so you guys get 4 stars, 5 stars, whatever. And it made me so frustrated. I hate it when I go on Amazon and I'm looking at reviews and I'm like, dang, this one has, you know, a bunch of 1 star reviews. What are they? And I go and read them and it says package arrived damage, book has a torn page. And I'm like, it just frustrates me because I'm there. I know Amazon's going to get the book to me or not get the book to me, whatever, but I'm there to find out, should I even buy this book? Or right. buy
People
this
weird.
Product. I want
it's
a review
about the product.
On how the product works, what it does. So,
I have two reviews on Amazon that are my favorite reviews on my book, on one of my books, and they were the books that I made, the ebooks that I made on my own. Mm-hmm. And one of them has 1 star. This book is amazing. Your kids will love it. So I'm like, I don't never understood that.
The gold star approval.
I'm like, this person did not understand and they messed me up. And the second one was 1 star. Now, keep in mind, this ebook was clearly listed in the 3 to 5 year old section.
Yeah. Yeah.
1 star. This book is too childish for my 11 year old.
What? That's so frustrating.
Leave reviews, there's some, you can't blame that kind of stuff. And you got to look at what the product's intended for. It's so frustrating. I mean, we need to educate people on how to leave good reviews.
Impossible. Education will never happen in this
world. It has to. It can't be this difficult. I actually got into an argument with somebody on an Amazon review site where, you know, how there's like Facebook battles. Uh-huh. I did that on Amazon because I critiqued his review. And then he responded, and so we're going back and forth. Yeah, he responded because it was exactly that. He was talking about the shipping, and I was like, dude, the shipping is not the product. Don't learn how to review. I was kind of aggressive because everyone is on the internet. He's like, well, why don't you learn how to? I'm going to leave my 1 star. I'm going to change everything to 1 star. You know, he's like.
Oh, boy. It really brings out the best in everyone, doesn't it? So how do you review? What's your system for reviewing something?
You have to look at who the intended audience is, and then match, like Will was saying, match the star system with your actual review. There's a bunch of times where if somebody will leave a glowing review and put no stars, and they just don't click the star thing, well, that shows up as an extremely negative rating, even though the words they used are positive. Yeah. And so you guys got it. If you're going to review something, click the appropriate star amount. This is not rocket science.
Do you want to know why I don't leave reviews on Amazon?
Yeah.
It's a technology thing that I do not understand. So they send me an email going, hey, you didn't review this product that you bought, the specific product, right? click here to leave a review. So what happens when I click there? It wants me to log in. I don't know what my login is.
You don't know your login for Amazon? That's
such a Will Terry problem.
I don't know what my login is. If you know who I am, when I click that link, you should have me logged in.
Oh, this is from the same guy when we'll say, hey, Will, did you get that email? And we'll be like, I sent it to your SVS email. And he's like, wait, we got emails at SVS? This is like five years in.
I try to stay ignorant just enough so that I don't have as much responsibility.
Why are you already logged in? You should be already logged in.
I am on my phone. If I go on my phone, I am. So but the email on my phone still makes me re-log in.
Yeah, and sometimes it automatically kicks you out with time. Anyway, let's move forward. So me and Jake were talking about things that we rate and things that we like, and each of us figured out that we have a rating system for a couple of very individual things. Jake, what have you come? You said it was movies, right? That you have a personal system.
I have a rating system I came up with during the pandemic, right?
What's your rating
for movies? So my rating system is, it's a 5-star system, and you get a star, a full star, half star, or no star if in 5 different categories. Okay, so I judge the movie on number 1. Was the story or the idea, was it compelling? Did I like it? And was the script written well enough to like match that storytelling idea? If I like it, full 1 star. If it was okay, 0.5 star. If I didn't like it, 0 star. Okay, so that's 1 star out of the way. The next is the acting and the characters. You know, you can have a good story, but the acting can ruin it, or the characters can ruin it, or you can have a bad story, but love the characters. So if I like the characters, they get a star. Third is the musical score. Does it support the story well? Is it, Hans Zimmer, he's always going to get a full star for me, for sure. But is it just background noise and it doesn't really add anything? No star. The 4th star option is art direction or design. Visually, is it impressive? Does it look cool? You know, color theory, does it match with what the story's doing? Things like that. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, direction / cinematography, like how the director chooses to, place the camera, all the decisions that a director makes that applies to everything else in it. So it's like an overall star in the direction. So from that, I can just go through those things and easily come up with, this is a 3-star movie, which most of the Marvel movies, 3 stars I give them. So every once in a while, there's a 3.5, 4-star. And if I like everything in it, easily it's a 5-star. And then there's always like, regardless of whatever, I'll go through and I'll do all of the stars and figure that out. And then if it made me cry, it just gets an extra star.
Crying star. I would say Pulp Fiction is a 5-star on that scale.
Yeah.
Do you ever see
that
Pulp
Fiction? Does everything. I gave Avatar, James Cameron's Avatar.
That was great.
I gave that a 5-star. I love it. I love every bit of it.
What?
I do too. You're
unobtainium.
Well, do not say anything against Avatar.
I like the movie, but it's 4. It's definitely a 4-star.
Well, I gave it 5.
It's a 5-star to you.
There's some stupid script in that movie.
There's some brilliant stuff too.
Jake,
I don't want to talk about. That's
an amazing system, Jake. I want to talk to you a little bit more about that.
The Matrix.
We just watched that. It holds up pretty well. We didn't think it would because how far technology.
You know what?
It actually holds up pretty well.
It does because they used retro imagery.
Interesting. I like that.
So what's your system?
I have a bathroom rating system because we travel a lot. And so
that's amazing. Of course you have a bathroom rating system.
Well, it's weird to go to the bathroom in public places sometimes. And I realized I didn't know I had this rating system until I was talking to Lisa about it. And she's like, are you rating these things? And I was like, I guess I am. And so I'll go through my 5-star rating system for bathrooms. If you're traveling, you're going to love this, especially if you're a guy, because the first one is 1-star is the lowest you can go. I don't have a 0-star rating, but the 1-star is no privacy, the urinal trough situation.
Oh,
if you don't know what this is, you're a girl and you don't know what this is. This is just an open trough where guys just line up and go to the bathroom. Oh my God, there is nothing worse than that in the history. How could that even have been thought of?
This is a new low, you guys.
I have a shy bladder. I can't do it. I stand there and then I get nervous that I'm not going to be able to pee and then I can't pee.
It's called bashful bladder. Those are left over from like the 40s.
You know, there's still like there. I mean, like I haven't seen one of those in a while. But if you, I think at certain clubs, and especially if you go to like punk rock clubs and stuff like that, they're still around. Like the smaller, cheap clubs.
Mm-hmm. And when you go in and see one of those, you hear the music, dun 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 dun, and then you see like the other guys looking at you like, are you gonna?
Yeah, it's like a Western situation. I will leave a club. Man. Even if I'm having a good time, I will come back out. We're leaving. We're going home. I'm not going to the bathroom there. Okay, now my two-star is limited privacy, very basic. Like, this is your basic gas station, Quick Mart kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Not very clean. There's some tiles missing. You got about like 6-inch little divider between the urinals and stuff.
Right.
That's a two-star. If there's a stall, it's not lockable. That's like a nightmare situation. Don't even want to talk about that. Number three star is a little bit better privacy. It's clean. It's nice. Still Quickie Mart, but a nicer one, like a newer one. And right. And the stalls are lockable if you need them. Number four is the coveted solo single bathroom where you go in and it's just like one bathroom. There's not other people that can come in. It's lockable.
You can just take ownership for all day.
You take ownership. And it's basic, but then your five-star bathroom is solo, lockable, and there's some upgraded design. Like, it's nice in there.
I see.
That's my five-star system.
See, I would do the same. I would do basically a version of my movie system for bathrooms. And that's, I would give a star. Does this bathroom have privacy? A star or not?
You're a fan. Clean? That's called a rubric, by the way. And if you guys ever get into teaching, or if you're a student, the best teachers use a rubric system because it really does show you. Hey, I had a good concept, but my perspective isn't good. I see how I'm bringing this back around to illustration because this podcast is going nowhere.
3-point perspective. The podcast about urinals, movie Absolutely star nothing. Systems.
And you haven't Amazon heard about reviews. my broken pain system though.
And, okay, which what's your pain system? Let's get through it.
And it doesn't work because in my world, you know how the doctors or the hospital, they want you to rate your pain level from 1 to 10. Well, for me, I'm like, I can imagine like being in complete agony, like screaming and like wanting to die, you know, because I've seen like, you know, I can't believe I survived, and these people describing, you know, like wishing they were dead because the pain was so bad. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's like a 10 or a 9, you know. Yeah. And I'm working backwards from there. And we went to the hospital the other day. I had to have a little checkup, and I had some pain going on. And I'm, you know, they're asking me over the phone, what's your pain level? And I'm like, that's probably like it's really bad. It's like a 4 or 5. And my wife is like, you're not going to get any attention. You're not going to get seen.
It is messed up.
It's messed up. And I'm like, I can go, this is really bad. I can't concentrate on watching TV or anything, but I can imagine this going way up the scale, higher than this. And she's like, no, it's a 7 or an 8. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And it was true because they didn't, they were like, oh, well, if it's just that, take some ibuprofen kind of a thing. And then she had to like convince me to say, well, actually on your pain scale, anyway.
I have another system too. If it's a scale of 1 to 10, like you can use that, but you have to eliminate 7. So it immediately, because everybody like kind of goes, you know, hey, how much fun are you having here at Disneyland? Is it, you know, is it or how great was that movie? 1 to 10 or you know, how much pain are you in? People always go to 7 because 7 is not a 10. It's not like bad or the best, but it definitely isn't like a 6 or a 5, right? So they all go to 7. If you eliminate 7, Now you really have to make a decision. Am I an 8 or am I a 6? Because that's saying something. 8 is like so close to 10. 6 is so close to average. You have to like, it really makes you decide. Anyways, well, first question.
Hold on. I got to counterpoint that. Okay. Because I noticed when I was teaching, a lot of times students, while they're, you know, you're doing working class stuff, students will be talking about, you know, books or movies or whatever. And I noticed something over the past 10 years that has changed. I used to get a lot of the 7s, 6s and 7s and stuff like that. But now, the last couple of years, I notice a change where it's either I absolutely loved it and it's the best thing I've ever seen, or I absolutely hate it and it should never have been made. Like, really, and polarized. It's just weird, this super polarized kind of opinion where there's no gray area in between. And so I actually had a discussion with my class about it because I noticed it and I was like, there has to be a redeeming quality, like on your scale, like, okay, maybe the writing wasn't good, but the art direction was pretty good, or, you know, something. But, and so, so I was trying to pull the students out of that kind of all or nothing kind of thought.
Interesting. All right. We got a few questions I wanted to have us go over today. First one is from Sabine, and it's titled Rejecting a Job. She says, how do you politely decline a job offer? What are good reasons to decline a job? I have trouble saying no. What do you guys think about that? You guys have any problems rejecting jobs, or what do you say when you do reject a job?
It's actually a good question, because like, if you've never worked before, you may think to yourself, why would you ever reject a job? But at some point you will start getting enough work where it's going to come up. It's going to either be, you know, not the right project, or maybe you're already busy on something else. So I do respect this question because there's a nuance to it. This is one of the main reasons that I like having an agent, because it puts the bad guy, you can play good cop, bad cop with the agent being the bad cop. And you don't feel quite as guilty. But I always say just a super polite thank you. And then I try not to lie and say like, oh, I'm busy right now, if I don't want to do the job, because then they'll say, oh, we can move some stuff around. We'll wait for you. And then you're like, oh, gosh, walked into that one. So I try to be as honest as I can and say, you know, it's too similar to something I'm already writing, or you know, something along those lines where it's a good cut. And but then at the end, I always say, please keep me in consideration for upcoming projects, because I love hearing from you and I love seeing what the projects are. That's always how I end it.
That's really good. I think in this question, there's really, you could break this into different categories, because there's reasons why you're rejecting the job. There's reasons why you're wanting to turn it down. Like you mentioned, it might be that you're busy. It might be that there's not enough money that they're offering. It might be that that you don't like working on that subject matter, or even it goes against your personal convictions on, you know, like if you're really into saving the environment, and it's a company that you don't agree with their mission, you may want to turn it down for that reason, you know. So I think you have to identify the reason that you're turning it down. You make a great point, Lee, that if you lie, they will. I early on, I did that, you know, well, I'm busy. Well, we can give you more time, you know? And so then you're like, so you really need to address, the reason. If it's not enough money though, I would say you're not doing the industry and yourself any, good by saying you're busy or making up some other excuse. If it's not enough money, you'll help yourself and all the other illustrators by letting them know that it's not enough and how much you would need. And if they turn you down and they don't work with you, you've at least implanted that they can't buy all of us for that lower price, you know, and that helps push prices up. That's my belief. So I think that's super important.
Yeah. I have a response that I just copy and paste. I feel like I want to share it here, but I don't want it to, I don't want it to get overused.
Not everybody is. Jake's going to post this in the show notes. And so you guys can,
You got to share it.
Okay. So it usually goes like this. This is, you know, someone, wants to collaborate on something. They need me to illustrate something or whatever. And here's this is if I really want, well, it goes back to that decision, that that thing that we said, Lee. It's if it's not a hell yes, like yes, I really want to do this, then it's a no. And I've really come to learn that, where it's like, if I kind of want to do this thing, and yeah, you know, I'll do it, and then I get into it and I realize like I don't have time for this. This project's gonna suffer because I'm spread too thin. You know, I didn't take enough off my plate. That's where I've really come to learn, like, you have to say no unless you're really, really into it. Mm-hmm. And so my email usually is, I thank them for reaching out, because I do appreciate them, that they would think of me. I tell them that I'm honored that they would want to work with me, because I do think of it as an honor. But this is what I say. I said, however, this year I'm dialing way back on collaborations and trying to focus on doing fewer things, but with more intent. And that is like the truth, you know. If it is a collaboration, because I've done years where I've done just said yes to everything and I've been swamped and like it's too much, you know. And so I tell them that I'm just doing fewer things and this is not one of the things that I want to do. And I tell them I got a pass on this, but thank you for thinking of me. And if it is somebody that I do want to work with in the future, then I'll add that part, like, hey, reach out again next time, you know, next time something else comes up or mm-hmm. something like that. So
we should talk about opportunity cost, because that's always a factor in whether you should say no and how to say no to a project. Everything you say yes to means you're going to say no to every single other thing that's going to come your way, because you're going to be mm-hmm. doing that thing. Yep. So that's kind of speaking to Jake's point, is that if you're not on board with it, you're turning down things that you could be really excited about and maybe mm-hmm. make more money or whatever, you know? So that's always something I think about now.
There's another system too, where I forget who I heard this from or where I learned this from, but it was some entrepreneur or something, but they said, if this is something that you would clear your schedule this afternoon to work on, then say yes to it. If not, pass on it, because you're going to say yes to it 6 months down the road. And guess what? That afternoon, you're going to want to do some other things anyway, or have to do some other things anyway. You're going to have to clear your schedule for that project anyway. So, so tell yourself, you know, that's how how you figure out if this is something you really want to do, or if it's mm-hmm. a no.
Another aspect is if you're successful enough to, you know, have a full plate of work, which happens a lot. We've all been in that situation where we absolutely cannot take on anything more. And over the years, I've turned down hundreds of jobs. In fact, there was one month in 1999 where I was keeping a calendar. Because I was doing primarily editorial and advertising work at that time. And I had so much coming in that I was writing it on a calendar to keep my jobs straight when things were due, what uh-huh. jobs were coming in. And I got to the point where I physically couldn't do any more work. That was one of those times. And I ended up that year turning down $70,000 worth of work that I had written on that calendar. Whoa. And added it all up. Wow. Yeah. And a whole nother career. In fact, that was a time where I was thinking about, could I hire someone to help me get some of this money? Uh-huh. But then when I really thought about it, I thought the administration cost would be, I didn't feel like there was quite enough there to really mm-hmm. Go
if
after.
If you're turning down $300,000, right. there'd be enough, you could
I tried
staff.
To do that. I tried to hire an illustrator that I would pass off the drawings and give them color notes, and then they would do the paintings and mm-hmm. send them in. And oh my gosh, it ended up so bad.
Yeah, I've done it twice for jobs that were just really big jobs that I didn't want to turn down, and it didn't ever work out right. I ended up having to do a lot more work. But the point with going there for me is I would always tell the client. Like you said, Lee, you know, like, boy, because you never know, you've got to know that just because you're way up here today, you might be way down
right.
in a month or two or three or next year. So I would always tell them, look, I loved working with you on that last project, or I would love to work with you. This looks like a fun project, even if it wasn't. This is a white lie that I would tell. because I'm hedging for the future, right? So, right. So it's like, I would love to work with you on this, even if I didn't. But I can't right now. Please consider me for future projects. Because I don't know where I'm going to be next year. Maybe I'm dying for work, you know? Mm-hmm. And I would always do that.
There's another little thing you can add that I started doing a couple of years back that says, is it okay if I contact you when my schedule clears up or
that's
when I
great.
Become available? And then that way it puts you in the driver's seat instead of like, okay, you can send me something if there's a project.
Right,
I like being where I can make the contact.
And humans don't like getting turned down. So you turn down the human. They're not like a robot. They're not like a computer. The next time they have a project, they may, even though you told them, please contact me in the future. I want to work with you. Nah, you turn me down. So they might just go to someone else. But if you are proactive and come back to them and go, hey, I would just, you know, based on that, the offer before, I'm available. You may trip stuff. So,
yeah, that's really cool. That's important. So I think we got that one. We answered that question. Let's do the next one. These are two questions that kind of go hand in hand. One's from Joseph, one's from Jim. Joseph asks, where do I start? He says, hello, I'm 18. I want to get into making graphic novels. I don't think it's a good question for this podcast, but anyway. Well, I've made graphic novels, and since I'm the one running things around here, I'm going to take a question on graphic novels. He says, I know I need to start on something small, like a comic strip, but I don't know where to start. Should I work on my illustration skills first, or should I just start on something? Where would you guys start on a project? Or even, have you ever done a graphic novel? And the reason I took this one is it's really a question about not graphic novels, but where should I start on any project? And people get this, you know, have this question too with children's books. Like, how do I start with a children's book? How do I start, you know, any of these long multi-illustration projects? And I think that's a good, valid question. Like, should I start small? Should I learn how to illustrate better first? Should I wait till I'm a better artist before I do that? So my answer with any one of these is, you do need to get to a certain level of artistic ability. Like, you got to understand the fundamentals, essentially. So before you ever start a comic project or a children's book or anything like that, like, you should be able to have an understanding of perspective, light and shadow, some color theory, form and structure and gesture. So, like, how to pose a character in different poses, how to give objects like structure and depth to them so they feel dimensional. Composition as well. I think understanding composition. And just having basic understanding of that first will help you when you take on these projects, because you won't be getting frustrated with your artistic abilities, and you could focus on your storytelling abilities, which is what graphic novels, comics, picture books, you know, any sort of illustration leans heavy on storytelling abilities and how well you can, like, have the characters acting the way you want them to act and have the composition set up the way you want it set up. So fundamentals first, then you can start dipping your toe in it. And what I did was, I wanted to do a graphic novel. I knew I wasn't ready to do 180 pages or 120 pages, however long a graphic novel is. So what I started doing was short stories. I would do a 5-page comic. I would do a 10-page comic. And I did 10, 15 of these short stories before I ever did a graphic novel. And what that did was it taught me, like, really what goes into making a comic page, what goes into, like, how many panels you need to get a particular story telling point across. It taught me so much on a small scale that I could, like, have these easy, clear wins and not feel frustrated that I wasn't, like, getting where I needed to get, or, you know, graphic novel takes a year, 2 years working on it a lot of, you know, spending a good chunk of your day on it. And by breaking it down into these smaller things, I think it gave me these wins and this confidence to move forward. Same thing with children's books, right? How would you guys go about like doing a children's book? Would you just take on a children's book project right out of the gate, or would what would you do to lead up to that?
I think your advice is good to go for some smaller options. I love early in my career, I did a lot of some magazine work, I guess, but for children's publishers like Cricut and Spider and Highlights and all that stuff. And what they would do is give you a story. It's like 4 or 5 pages, and then you get maybe a page or a spread, and then a couple of small spots. And those are such great, easy ways. You're not dealing with a massive layout and, you know, 32 pages with a character. You're dealing with just a couple of images, but you are moving characters through sequential storytelling, which is a huge deal. And so that's always going to be a big win. But I also have changed my children's book approach over the years too. I think a lot of times people, when they go into a bigger project, like a, say I want to do a children's book, they start with the dummy and they do all this. They basically lay it out so the whole book comes up at the same time from sketch to finished work. And I think the project suffers from that because it's just such a long thing. Like you said, it could take a year to do a good children's book. So right from the get-go, if I say I want to do a children's book, if I was going to do a graphic novel, I'd do the same thing. The first thing I would say is make some piece of flashy finished art, like your favorite spread from the whole thing. It doesn't even have to end up in the actual project, but that's how I would always start, because then you can print it out, pin it up, and say, if the whole thing can be this good, it's going to be awesome. I mean, it's enough to get you excited about it and to drive how the images look. It even helps having that one image to then drive the thumbnails for the rest of the pages. You can say, okay, right, I abstracted the background here, so I need to do that in the thumbnails. You know what I mean? So even doing a couple of pages like that, basically just, you know, sell pages, or, you know, this finished pages, I highly recommend doing that at the beginning, because it just drives the whole project. Especially the bigger the project, the more you need a couple of little things in the beginning to sustain you.
Yeah.
Did you guys view this question as coming from a self-publishing or a self-project, or after you've gotten the assignment or going after those assignments?
I think, well, he says he's 18 and he wants to get into making graphic novels. So I think at this stage, when you're that young and you know, possibly not that experienced yet, it's going to be more of a self, personal project, like a self-made, self-assigned projects.
Yeah.
And that was really, I look at anybody doing graphic novels right now, and I can't think of anyone who didn't start by doing their own, you know, web comic or short stories or something personal that kind of got them the recognition or the eyeballs that they needed by the people who actually publish graphic novels. So you're going to want to do that. My advice is start doing a 5-page story. Whether it's a picture book or a graphic novel, just do 5-page story. Tell a concise, and a story can be as simple as, you know, a character's hungry, they want to eat an apple from a tree, and something blocks them from doing that, and they figure out a way to solve that and get the snack. You know, that's as simple as it needs to be. And if you could do that creatively, you're going to learn so much from just telling that kind of story. And then you can move on to more complex stories, more things about characters, more things about emotions, things like that. So I would do that. The next thing here, Jim asks, comics versus picture books. Hi guys, which do you enjoy working on most, comic books or picture books? What are the main difference between the two from a workflow perspective? And does one take significantly longer to complete than the other if you're both writing and illustrating? Now, have you guys ever done some form of comic work in your illustrative careers, or has it all been strictly like children's book illustration?
We don't stoop down to that level, Jake.
We're high.
Aspire to those heights.
You know, I feel intimidated by the whole graphic novel or comic book kind of a thing. So I've never done it. It's not been in my wheelhouse at all.
Let me ask you, what's intimidating about it?
The sheer amount of work. I remember Nate Hale talking about doing his graphic novels and basically like locking himself in the library. Like that was his place. Cause I guess he didn't have I don't know what the reason was. I don't want to speculate, but he didn't want to do it at home. So he would go to the library and just stay there from morning till night.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, he was telling me about it one day, cause we shared a room and we went to this convention in LA and we were talking about it, and you know, and he's like, I'm insane for doing this kind of work. And they were thick books, you know, I mean, like he did the Hazardous Tales series.
Right.
He wasn't working on that
huge,
at that time.
By the way. It's a huge, huge series now.
Yeah. So it's always been intimidating, just the sheer amount of, I like to render. That's my happy place, is to, when I get the illustrations, you know, the drawings finished, and I can enjoy putting on some sort of a video or listening to music and just painting.
Yeah.
You don't do that in a graphic novel as much. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. It seems like too much production work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I've done graphic novels out on children's books, and graphic novels are an enormous amount of work. There's no easy way to do a graphic novel. You're just going to have to spend a lot of time on it, because they're, you know, they're 100 plus pages, and each page is has multiple characters on it, multiple scenes, multiple environments. I think that's why graphic novels often are inked line drawings, because it's so easy to finish a drawing in pen and ink than it is to render it out. You know, you see some of these French comics that are really lavishly illustrated, but they're only 40 pages long, but still those things take them a year or 2 years to do them. So from a workflow perspective, it's essentially the same thing. You're planning out a page, you're thumbnailing, you're, you know, laying it out, you're doing the line work, then you're rendering. It's just that there's so many more pages in a graphic novel than there is in a children's book. The reason I like doing graphic novels though, and I prefer doing them over children's books, is I like the storytelling and the world building and the character development that you could do in a graphic novel. I could tell essentially a cinematic style story in a graphic novel that I don't feel like I can get quite across in a children's book. And the audience for graphic novels aligns more with my tastes and my level of interest than the audience and the subject matter usually for children's books. So that's why I prefer it. The reason I haven't done as many of those as I've done children's books is they just take so long. they take so much time, and I'd rather...
I tell you, seeing Sean Tan's, the book, The Arrival, or even the Hugo Cabret book.
Yeah.
That's the only two that really got me, like, changed how I thought about that whole idea of doing a book that big, and they pulled it off, you know, beautifully. Mm-hmm. And it just makes me, I'm just holding it going, oh man, why have I not done this?
Yeah.
And then I sit down and start, I'm like, no, it's too much.
Yeah. The Arrival is amazing.
So I'm holding it up. If you're listening to us on YouTube.
Yeah. You guys watch us on YouTube. You can watch. It's riveting to see our faces. It's
What's our YouTube channel?
You can see us picking our nose. but Sean Tan's one of these artists who does the children's books. He does the comic stuff. He's done all kinds of different things. I'd definitely check him out if you haven't. All right.
Our YouTube channel is Society of Visual Storytelling. Let me just throw that in there. So that
They're a sponsor of this podcast, by the way. Should we do a little plug before we get to the end?
Go for it. Do it.
You always do it. I don't have a thing planned for that.
All right. SVSLearn.com. Check it out. That's where the three of us have classes along with other teachers. We talk about, you know, we talked about the foundations in this episode, and we have a series of classes that are the fundamentals or the foundations, which teach light and shadow. It teaches how to draw structurally so that your drawings have weight and depth to them. It teaches character design. It teaches prop design, all the different things, perspective, those things. So go check it out. And you could subscribe and get these classes. Subscribe for a low monthly fee. I think it's like $25, $30, something like that. You get access to the fundamental classes plus 80 different courses all on teaching on different levels, teaching illustration on different levels. All right. The last question here.
Nice. Well,
this is from Noah. What have you learned from master studies? So hi, Jake, Will, and Lee. I have another question. I hear you talking a lot about master studies, and I myself have done a master study too and learned a lot from the process. I was wondering if you'd like to share some specific elements of your style or techniques that you learned directly from a master study. Do you remember any light bulb moments when you figured out how an artist achieved this composition or that lighting technique, and you decided to use that and saw a notable difference in your own work as a result? So that's a question. Have you guys had any aha moments or any big takeaways from doing master studies, and what were they?
Yes.
I've had a ton of those. I love master copies. I still do them. I think they're great. There's the learning that happens from the media that you're doing just to lay down a painting. Like I remember in school, I did an NC Wyeth, traditional paintings. I tried to match the materials as best I could. And when I give a master copy, by the way, in my classes, I use the same thing I had when I was a student, is that you should not be able to tell the original from the copy. That's how close they need to be to really get down. And if you're doing a John Singer Sargent copy and it's a bunch of loose brush strokes, you have to intentionally copy his brush strokes, but they still have to be loose. It's really fantastic exercise. That's crazy. But the bigger thing that I take from it is when I get done with a master copy, I then list out my hypothesis of what makes this painting work. And so it could be, I go through sort of like a rubric, like Jake was talking about. What's the value? What's the edges? What's the color balance or the palette? All kinds of stuff like that. And then I list it out and I write answers to that. And then I'll go find another piece from that same artist and try to go through the checklist and say, okay, does my hypothesis about this painting, this one painting, hold up over the rest of the body of work? And if it doesn't, if I came up with something for that one painting and it doesn't match the rest of the body of work, I try to modify it until I get, five key things that makes this painter a great painter. And by coming up with those five things, that is the most valuable thing, not necessarily the singular copy.
Mm-hmm. I see. That's cool.
I think that you look at any artist's work, if the three of us were given the same assignment, we'd have three completely different finishes, and that would be the same for giving it to any illustrator, anyone listening. If we all did the same assignment, we would all have different pieces. And so I think when you approach a piece of art, when you sit down to make something that starts with a drawing and starts with, well, it starts with composition and then drawing and then finally rendering, there are maybe 1,000 things, maybe 10,000 things, maybe more that you've learned since you were a toddler, since you were a little baby to now. And each one of those things, they're not things that you're thinking about while you're drawing anymore. They become part of you. They become part of your way of thinking. And you forget about them. So for me to say, well, I learned this, I do remember doing master copies, and I do remember gaining compositional elements of cropping in and going, wow, look at how this artist is using their space. I would have never on my own made that decision to divide the space. It's so abstract to talk in these terms without showing the actual thing, right, which is long gone because I learned it 30 years ago. But I think there's probably thousands of those things that we picked up, And I think that doing master copies accelerates that process. Mm-hmm. So I think that you know, you can, I would imagine that you could find really accomplished illustrators that never did master copies. They mm-hmm. just, they picked it up in looking and in doing other things. But I'll bet that it is a fast track. I would imagine doing master copies is definitely a fast track, especially yes. if you're copying. And here's the thing. I only copied illustrations that I loved, that I was jealous that I didn't create that illustration. You know, I was envious and I wanted it. And I did the copy and this was in school. And got too close to some artists that I was copying, you know, to where my peers would say, well, I guess we know who Will's looking at this week, you know, or
that's
you know,
always sort of embarrassing, right? It shouldn't be embarrassing, but that's always embarrassing. Like you got your hand caught in the cookie jar.
Right. But you know, you don't stop innovating. So you take what you've learned and then you move on to another artist. And eventually mm-hmm. your style becomes an amalgam of all the people that you're looking at yeah. and seeing and stuff. So
that's why I like, there's a exercise I like where you take two different styles and you try to do a combination of the two. So
I love that.
A couple of years ago, I did, you know, there's a French comic artist named Mobius, and I did a Dr. Seuss Dr. Seuss subject matter in his style.
That's awesome.
Did an illustration that way. And I thought, because I was looking at a Seuss book and I was like, man, this has a Mobius vibe to it. I don't know why I connected the two, but you learn a lot because you're pulling from, you know, the essence of these two artists, and you actually make something unique in the process.
I like it too. It gets you out of your own way of making things, like, oh, here's how I draw an eyeball, or here's how mm-hmm. I draw a mouth or a nose. And you look at, like, we were watching Carmen Sandiego with my son, and they have this really interesting way of abstracting the nose on some of the male characters. And so I pulled out my iPad and I was like, while we were watching the show, I'm just doing this, just the nose on this mm-hmm. one. But it was just such a unique way to do it. It was a way that I would never, ever have thought to do on my own. And I don't know if I'll use that in my work, or maybe I'll abbreviate it or something like that. But another example is, we were in Charleston last week and at the beach, and we're drawing with sticks in the sand. And my son's been watching The Simpsons. And so he had drawn a smiley face, and I was going to try to draw Bart Simpson's mm-hmm. head next to him. And it was awful. I realized I have no idea how to draw Bart Simpson's head. So then we went back in and like Googled it. Like, okay, that's how, you know, it's such a simple drawing. It's not like it's hard or anything, but I just had never done it before. I'd never make those shapes. Once you draw it a couple times.
I remember drawing him as a kid. I'm going to see if I can do it right now and see.
We were laughing because mine was so bad. He's like, Dad, you're a professional artist. I'm like, yeah, but I don't know what Bart Simpson looks like. I can't remember how to draw his eyes. And I know he's got this, like, from the three-quarter view, the mouth kind of sticks out at this weird abstracted. Let me see your Bart Simpson.
Who's my Bart? I have, like, components, but the proportions... The proportions are wrong.
It looks a little bit... It looks like Bart Simpson as Frankenstein.
Try this. Bart Simpson. Draw Charlie Brown from memory.
Oh, wow.
Oh, like, dude.
Simple design.
Can't do it.
It's like a circle head, right? It's just a circle. Yeah. And then it's a little squiggle curly hair. Q at the top. But what are the eyes? Now I can't. And I know the nose is just like a half circle, too. I mean, that's like, and his smile. I feel like I should be able to draw it. I'm going to do it.
Do it.
I've got a big old marker right here.
I'll wait till you draw yours to show you mine. I actually did this in one of my classes, and it was draw like these iconic characters from memory.
Oh God!
It was amazing to see what each student, like, what they remembered from these mm-hmm. these characters, what stood out. So it was like, draw SpongeBob, draw Mickey Mouse, draw Charlie Brown.
Okay, so here's my starting point. I do not know. that little line's errant, but the curly Q on top, I can't remember, but the eyes, I cannot remember
eyes. Aren't they glasses? They're glasses, right?
No, he doesn't wear glasses. Oh, he does. That's have right. dots for eyes.
Yeah. Right? They're Dang dots.
It. Okay. I'm going to show you, once I put the eyes in, it looks like a pumpkin. It looks like a pumpkin. Look, it's like a pumpkin. I didn't put eyeballs.
It looks like nightmare fuel. That's what that was. That's hilarious. Anyways, if you want to, if you really want to, like, if you're into doing character design, from memory, try to draw Mickey Mouse, Charlie Brown, SpongeBob, and I'll say, yeah, like Bart Simpson, right? Try to draw those from memory and hold those against the actual drawings and see what you got right, what you remembered, what you didn't. And that's like a window into when you're designing your own character, like what elements are going to separate your character from other characters. Like Bart has the spiky hair, you know, Matt Groening does those like bug eyes, like the eyes popping out. It's so unique, but you know, how do we even get on this? Oh, master studies. That's right.
Yeah. So, sorry. how quickly our conversations devolve.
That's how all of our meetings are. How do we get on this? Lee, why did you bring us into this?
I swear. If we have
do master copies. If you haven't done them, do some. They are so worth it.
If any more of our meetings involve Bitcoin, I don't know if I could.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Will has been on a kick lately. Oh, every time we talk to him, he's giving us investing advice now. He's coming to work in a suit.
What's even in your briefcase, Will? Like, I don't even. Why do you have that briefcase?
Half-eaten sandwich.
He's got an old '90s cell phone, like the brick cell phone, pinstripe suit. Feels like a '80s Wall Street investor. No. All right, let's take us out. Let's finish this one.
Let's end this nightmare.
This mess of a podcast episode. I'm grateful people listen to this.
Yeah. No, those were great questions.
I'm worried about
too.
You, though. I'm worried about you.
Those were great questions.
Yeah, they were good questions.
Those are good questions.
Okay, thanks for joining us, everybody. As mentioned before, 3-Point Perspective is made possible by SVS Learn, by svslearn.com. That's where becoming a great illustrator starts. Seriously, go check it out. Take some of the classes. See if you can't improve as an illustrator over there. And join our forum. Free to join. Post your artwork on there. Get some feedback. Give some feedback. We'd love to see you on there. Your hosts today have been Will Terry, Lee White, and I'm Jake Parker. Will Terry's artwork can be found at willterry.com and on Instagram at willterryart. Lee White's artwork can be found at leewhiteillustration.com and on Instagram at leewhiteillo. And my artwork can be found at mrjakeparker.com and on Instagram at jakeparker. Podcast produced by Daniel Tu. Special thanks to him for all he does, editing and getting these things out to your listening devices. You can see more of Daniel's work at daniel2.co. That's daniel2.co. Special thanks to our SVS production manager, David Bro, for all that he does to keep things running here. And thank you to our social media specialist, Lisa Flatt, for her help in getting these podcasts spread, the word about these podcasts spread out there. All right, everybody, thank you, and we'll see you next episode.